My name's Kate Wilson, as he said. A lot of people will know me as Katia. I've always been called Katia in the social movements. In the 1990s, I was involved in environmental direct action protest in the UK. I come from London. And I was part of a group called Reclaim the Streets. And in 2003, I was involved. Reclaim the Streets was an environmental direct action group that became an anti-capitalist organization or movement. And in 2003, I was involved in setting up the Dissent Network in the UK. And normally, I don't tell people what kind of political activism I'm involved in, but through those movements, I came into contact with actually quite a large number of undercover police officers. So the ones that I knew personally and was involved with is between 6 and 8. Some of them are not confirmed. And it gives an idea of the scale of the undercover policing that was going on in the UK at that time. In November 2003, or end of October, November 2003, I moved to Nottingham in the north, middle north of England. And at an open political meeting in the Anarchist Social Centre in Nottingham, I met a guy that I knew as Mark Stone. I was 25 at the time, and we got on well. We got very close very fast, actually faster than I remembered. When I saw the police files about our relationship, I realized that things that maybe in my memory took 1 or 2 months actually happened within like a week. He was new. Like, he wasn't somebody I knew. I knew a lot of people on the scene already, and he was new, he was interesting, and he seemed to share a lot of my interests. I mean, even quite weird interests, like I have always liked country and Western music, which is really not common in the anarchist scene, and so did he. And so we had, like, all these things in common really fast. We started mobilizing together, and within a couple of months we'd organized an office occupation at the offices of Bayer, the company that was taking over genetically modified crops in the UK at the time. We'd organized an action to climb the fences at an immigration detention center, and we'd organized the first big gathering of the Dissent Network. And these were things that I did together with him in the first like few months of our relationship. He met my family. He used to come and stay with my parents. He very quickly, in December 2003, he moved into a shared house with some friends of mine. And in May of 2004, I moved in as well. He was the first boyfriend that I ever lived with. And we were together until February 2005, when I left the UK and I moved to, well, first back to Barcelona, where I'd lived before, and then here to Berlin. And he went on to have other relationships with friends of mine in the UK, and we stayed close friends, and he followed me to Barcelona, and he followed me to Berlin. And I guess there's a few people here in the room now who knew Mark Kennedy, who met him either in Barcelona or Berlin. I know Matthias did. He was arrested at least twice in Germany doing actions. He was arrested once in Berlin for setting fire to a garbage bin, I think, and once in, I think, 2007 in Heiligendamm during the G8 protests there. And it's very hard to know how to tell this story because obviously now I know a lot more about what was happening then. But I do know that a lot of people in Berlin trusted Mark or welcomed Mark because he was my friend. And I now know, and I'll get to this in more detail later, but I now know that this was very intentional by the British police. So I've seen files about myself that say, Mark says to his handler, you know, Katia doesn't want to go to the dissent meeting in Hamburg. And his handler says, no, no, we really need her to be there. So you have to lend her the money so that she will go.
Probably you explain what a handler is. You will come to that later, but a handler?
Oh God, how do I explain a handler? So yeah, he's the management, but specifically the handler. I don't know if there's a German translation for this word, but
Polizeiführer, perhaps something like Führungsperson.
No, he was the contact person from the police that Mark was talking to, and anybody who knows Mark will remember he was always on his mobile phone. Like before everybody had a mobile phone, Mark was the original phone addict. He was always texting, he was always making phone calls, and I now know that most of those phone calls and most of those texts were not to his job or to his friend, they were to his handler.
No, they were to his job.
Well, they were to his job. Yeah, different job. Because he would tell me that he worked as a delivery driver. He would be talking to his uncle, he said, who he worked for sometimes, about driving some package to the airport or driving something to, anyway, he said he was talking to his driving job, but actually he was talking to his police handler and passing the information all the time, sometimes every hour, passing the information about what he was doing. In 2010, a woman who is a close friend of mine, has anonymity. She doesn't like people to know who she is, but she goes by the name of Lisa. She was on holiday with Mark. They'd been together for 6 years. And she found a passport in his van while she was waiting for him that had a different name with his picture. And it said that he had children. And it's not so unusual in our movements to find out that somebody uses a different name. But it's pretty weird to find out somebody you've been in a relationship with for 6 years has children that you didn't know about. And she told some people about this, and they started to investigate, and eventually they found the birth certificates of his children, and they said the profession of the father is on the birth certificates in the UK, and it said he was a police officer. And in October 2010, they confronted him, and he confessed that he had been working for the police. By October 2010, he wasn't working for the police anymore, but that he had been until the beginning of that year. And that's when the Indie Media article was published that you talked about. And I found out because they phoned me up before they published the Indie Media article to say, like, before, we don't want you to find this out by accident from the internet. Like, you need to know that this guy that you lived with and used to be in love with was a police officer. And that was 16 years ago, nearly 16 years ago. And it's quite difficult now to talk about the emotional impact that had at the time. I think, you know, we were anarchist direct action movements. We knew we were probably being spied on. We thought that our phones would be bugged. And we would think that people coming to our meetings were maybe spies. We always thought that the people coming to our meetings who might be spies were the weird people, the awkward people, the ones who made you feel a little bit uncomfortable, the ones who sat in the corner and maybe didn't talk to anybody and left early. They weren't the spies. What we know now is that the spies were the ones who were really well trained to make you feel comfortable emotionally and make you feel like they were your close friend, and they were the ones who were right in the middle and doing the organizing. And that was something that nobody that I know who was close to these police officers was prepared for, politically or emotionally. And, you know, a lot of time has passed since then, and in that time we set up a number of campaign groups and we took the court cases against the police, and now we have this ongoing inquiry that is going to last forever, I think. It's like it just never ends. And I wrote a book. That's why I'm here. But yeah, so because of all that, like, emotionally, I'm in a very different place now than I was back then. And so it's very hard, and it was very hard writing the book to try and tell both stories, because it's almost like what I lived and what I experienced when I was going out with Mark and I didn't know happened to a different person to me now, knowing. And even what I experienced and what I lived when I found out Mark was an undercover cop, before I got all of the police files and I got the understanding, again, it's like it happened to a different person. Because when you find out that something so fundamental wasn't what you thought, it does something to your understanding of your own memories and your own life story. And makes it very, very difficult to tell it in a talk like this in a systematic way. So when Mark was uncovered, there were the process of finding out that Mark was a police officer involved a number of women getting together and talking about the experiences that they had. Because Mark was not the only police officer who was undercover inside the social movements, deceiving women into intimate sexual relationships. And shortly after Mark was, well, maybe just about a year after Mark was uncovered, I was invited to a meeting where I met with seven other women who had all been through similar experiences. And some of those women had had relationships with Mark Kennedy as well, like I did. Some of those women had relationships with police officers back in the 1980s, in the 1990s. And some of those women had been searching for years for the men that they had been in love with who had disappeared. And over the years, they had found little bits of information, tracing things that they remembered that their boyfriends had said, to come to the conclusion that they weren't real people, and eventually to come to the conclusion that they had been police officers. And the video that we were playing at the beginning was from one of these women. It was the guy that she had a lot of home video of her relationship, and it's quite a powerful video just to see how normal and like family life that it was. This guy here. And those women, when they told people that they thought that their partners had been undercover police officers or spies or security service, but they knew that they weren't who they said they were. People said to them, oh, you're crazy. You know, you're a difficult woman. He left you. Get over it. This isn't true. And when we had this meeting, by the time we had the meeting, there was enough information to say, yeah, this is definitely something that is happening. And we talked to each other and we talked about the relationships that we'd had and the things that we remembered. And people started to realize that. And I compare it to the early feminist movements from the 1970s, where women would get together and talk about their experiences of patriarchy and gradually realize that, oh, this is not just something personal that is happening to me in my private relationship. This is something systemic. And it was very much like that. So we started to realize that you meet this guy, and really early on, you have a lot of things in common, that he's basically reflecting the things about you that, like me liking country music. When I talked to the woman who was with Mark after me, his favorite music was drum and bass. It's like, oh, okay, that's kind of weird. And that was something that lots of the women recognized, was like, yeah, when I met him, he really shared my interests. Or a lot of them told us stories about traumas from their childhood. They talked about being abandoned by their families. They talked about being adopted. They talked about experiences of childhood sexual abuse. They talked about their parents dying. A lot of this stuff we now know is not true. These are stories that they made up, because by telling you about trauma, they make themselves look vulnerable, and they create trust, and they make you vulnerable in return. And so through having these conversations, we started to realize, okay, this isn't just one man who betrayed me in a relationship. This is something systemic. This is something that's happening over and over again. And now I think, through the inquiry, more and more undercover officers are being revealed, and we now have contact with around 60 women who were deceived like this into relationships by undercover police officers. And in 2010 as well, when Mark Kennedy was uncovered, there was this realization in the movement of, oh my God, if Mark Kennedy was an undercover cop, then anybody could be an undercover cop. And pretty quickly we realized that that's not actually true. So there were things about Mark Kennedy that made it possible for him to be an undercover cop that maybe with other people would not be the case. So generally speaking, and it's not 100%, but generally speaking, with undercover police officers, you won't meet their family. I know one case in Spain where they did, but they had an actress who played this guy's mother, and people went to meet him. But mostly there will be some reason why you won't have met their family. You know, all of these officers had employment that took them away. So Mark Kennedy was a van driver. He would go away sometimes for 1 or 2 weeks to drive delivery. So there's things that we started to realize and things that people started to research. And there's a group called the Undercover Research Group that searched all of the suspicions. People would go to them and say, hey, maybe this guy was an undercover police officer. And they researched meticulously, and they went and they interviewed people, and they put together a really interesting document which poses 15 questions to ask. Like, if you think somebody you know may be an undercover police officer, 15 things that they noticed from the cases that we were uncovering in the UK, that, you know, if you look at these things and a lot of them are ticking the boxes, then this is a good place to start. And I'm going way off what I'm supposed to be saying. But yeah, between the eight women who had that meeting, we decided to bring a court case against the police. And we did that together in at the end of 2011. We started the court case. And by 2015, I was on my own in the court case, because court processes in the UK, and it's really hard to explain even in England, but in Germany, where the court system is probably different, it's even more impossible to explain. But for a lot of complicated legal reasons, the other seven women had to settle their cases, and so by 2015...
And the risk of final losses, no? That
yeah.
you at the end have yeah. to pay everything if you lose.
Yeah. And in 2017, I also had to settle my claim, but I had another part of the legal case was under the Human Rights Act. And that claim actually went to court. And it was the first time, this is like 7 years after Mark Kennedy was uncovered. We'd had so many attempts at getting investigations, and we had the public inquiry and everything, but this weird human rights case that I was left with in 2017 was the first time that one of these court cases actually went to a court. And we thought that it was all going to be buried by official secrets and national security. But the court that heard the claim was a very weird secret human rights court that they have in the UK that's specially designed for hearing cases where the material is supposed to be secret, basically. So usually they can close the doors, and even the person making the claim can't go inside. They look at the evidence and they make a decision. They never tell you anything. And that court looked at the evidence and they said, this isn't about national security, and we don't have official secrets processes to protect the police from embarrassment. And we were surprised. I think the police were very surprised. And suddenly everything changed, and they said, yeah, we're going to give you all of this evidence and all of these files. And I got, in the end, more than 5,000 pages. It took more than a year. They kept giving us little bits. It was total chaos, but in the end, I got 5,000 pages of files about this police operation. And that's why I wrote the book, basically, because I wanted to be able to, well, two reasons. One is quite personal, was I wanted to rebuild my own life story, my own understanding of what had happened, put it together, and put it together next to the evidence from the police about what was really happening when I didn't know. But also because I just wanted to show people what was in those files. And it's very hard to show people what is in those files, because when I got them, I discovered that a lot of what's in the files is quite horrible. And I don't know if anybody has ever been presented with surveillance information where they're reporting on your relationships with your friends, and they're reporting on your phone conversations, and they're reporting on it's you know, every little secret is in there. And there were 500 other people apart from me named in these files that I got, and The first thing that I did when I saw them was I went back to the court and I said, this can't be public. You can't just publish all of this information about 500 people who have no consent and no involvement in this trial. So we got a court order to say that the names of people named in the files who aren't me or who haven't given their consent cannot be made public, which I think is really, really important to protect people's privacy, particularly like from things that happened 20 years ago that, you know, you just, this stuff just never should have been written down. And I'm not talking about like people doing criminal activity. I'm talking about, you know, information about people who cheated on their boyfriend or people who said something nasty about their friend because they were angry. Like, none of this stuff should have been in there. And it made it very hard to write the book because I had to write the book about me and not to write about other people. It's also very difficult coming from political movements that I come from, where we believe that nobody speaks on behalf of those movements and everybody speaks as an individual, to write something about the political time back then, that what we were doing and what we were thinking. But at the same time, I really want people to be able to see what the police were doing and how they were recording it in their files. So that's what the book is. It tells the story of the relationship that I had with Mark from my point of view and also from the police point of view and what they wrote down, and they wrote down a lot. And it tells the story of the trial and the process and the spoiler. I don't know if that is the right word. Oh my God. we won. That's the end of the book, but it's kind of out there. It's in the public, so I guess it's okay to say it. But it's still worth reading the book because you get all the secret police information. But yeah, we won at the end, and we won a lot because in the beginning it was only about the sexual relationships, and a lot of the lawyers when it first happened were like, you know, you can't, like, yes, it's wrong for police officers to deceive members of the public into sex, but, you know, we can't take them to court for spying on political movements. Like, that's what the state does. And we were like, yeah, but it's not what the state claims it does. It's not what the state says it should be doing. And in the end, we took them to court for spying on political movements, and we won that as well. And they said that it was a violation of the right to free association and the right to freedom of expression and the right to privacy of not only me, but people who are involved in political movements doing that. And that's where we come to the public inquiry, which Matthias was talking about and which we're still involved in. So a lot of what we, the eight women who started the case, wanted, we wanted the files about our lives and we wanted answers about our relationships and our lives. But obviously this is much, much bigger than that. In the course of uncovering the information that we uncovered about the men that we had relationships with, a lot more information started to come out. Do you want to go?
Testing. So the inquiry was launched when the Prime Minister at the time, Theresa May, heard back from the Ellison inquiry, which was into corruption in the police force around the investigation of the murder, the racist murder of Stephen Lawrence. And I think it was the third inquiry into the bodged investigation. And when the inquiry published its findings, an ex-undercover police officer called Peter Francis turned whistleblower and said that he had been tasked with spying on the family and the campaign for justice, the Stephen Lawrence campaign. And this information had not been revealed and disclosed by the Metropolitan Police when there was an inquiry taking place into their handling of the case. And that was one step too far. The judge who had performed that inquiry was outraged that he had been deceived. Just when he was about to publish his findings, they find out that there was further information that hadn't been disclosed to that inquiry. So Theresa May, the Prime Minister, announced that there would be an investigation into undercover policing. So this was 2014, I believe. So we'd already had the SpyCop scandal involving Mark Kennedy had already broken a few years earlier. And the Guardian newspaper, Rob Evans and Simon Lewis? Not Simon Lewis. Pooh Lewis had published the book Undercover. So the...
translated into German and is available at the bookstore.
So there was already... and then the Undercover Research Group had worked with them and had already named, I think, about 6 or 7 undercover officers. So Theresa May announces the inquiry, and I think it started in 2015. And from that point on, the police then started to spend, I think it was, last time we checked, it was $64 million in legal fees on making applications for anonymity and privacy and redacting and arguing about whether to disclose documents. So the inquiry was supposed to take 3 years. It hadn't even started hearing evidence within 3 years. I think it first started hearing evidence in 2021. The issues which the inquiry is looking at are quite far-reaching. So it's not just the deceiving women into sexual relationships. They're looking at the fathering of children by undercover officers. They're looking at the identity theft, taking dead children's identities, not just their names, but actually their kind of family history, background, locations. Undercover officers are looking into where they what schools they came from, their area, learning about their family background and using that as part of their identity, not far more than just stealing the names. They're looking at the use of information from undercover officers for blacklisting or vetting people involved in trade unions, so they will never get jobs in the construction industry, for example, preventing people from getting jobs in government or in places of influence, political vetting, basically. They're looking at the spying or reporting on politicians. So, for example, Jeremy Corbyn, Diane Abbott are both Labour MPs who were being extensively reported on. We've also, through the inquiry, had evidence of direct tasking of the political policing units by Margaret Thatcher and Michael Heseltine, who was the Home Secretary? I think it was Home Secretary at the time. 1983, they tasked the SDS to gather dirt in marginal seats before the general election when the campaign for nuclear disarmament was very popular and was endorsing, I guess, Labour MPs, and they wanted to make sure that they had dirt on the people who the Tory MPs were facing in the election.
Ben, perhaps you mentioned the SDS. That was one of the police organizations that was investigated, the Special Demonstration Squad.
Yeah.
And the NPYOU, which is the National Public Order Intelligence Unit.
So we might be able
and
to
they go back.
Back
to 1968, if I'm not mistaken. No, the investigation is looking at this, like, 50...
Yeah, so the SDS came into being after protests outside the American Embassy in London, in Grosvenor Square, turned a little bit violent. And the police didn't want to be caught out not knowing the strength of feeling, let's say, amongst protesters.
These were the protests against the Vietnam War in 1968.
So the other things that are coming up and being looked at specifically by the inquiry are the targeting of justice campaigns. These are families and friends of people who have been killed in racist murders or killed by the police, in contact with the police, in custody or during arrest. And it turns out that the police were using undercover officers to gather information about those campaigns and to gather dirt in order to try to discredit or disrupt those campaigns. Of particular interest was the Stephen Lawrence campaign, because that generated a huge amount of publicity and problems for the police.
Stephen Lawrence was a black teenager in London. He was murdered in 1997, I think. He was murdered in a racist attack, and the police looked at the case and they said, oh, he's a black teenager in London, it's probably about drugs, and they didn't investigate. And his family started a campaign, which has been going on now for 30 years, but it's probably the most kind of public relations damage that the police force in London has ever faced, when the family campaign got before a judge and the judge said, yeah, the police in London are institutionally racist. And it led to a lot of pressure on the police, a lot of reforms within the police, and it meant that every other racist murder or people who were killed by the police, like Jean-Charles de Menezes in 2005, who was shot dead by the police, who threatened the police's reputation, instead of properly investigating those incidents, they basically put their resources into spying on the families of those people and the people who were campaigning for justice.
Yes, and there's a lot of them, and quite a few of those campaigns or families are involved in the undercover police inquiry as core participants, and some of the most harrowing evidence has come from those very hard-watching, listening to their stories. Then we have miscarriages of justice, which go right back to the very beginning. These are court cases in which the police did not disclose the involvement of undercover officers to the courts. In some cases, the officers will have given evidence to the court as in their cover office, a cover identity. Abuse of process. And so the inquiry is looking at these cases, and then they recommend them to be revisited. So already there have been quite a few of those miscarriages of justice which have the original rulings have been overturned. And this goes back to I think the first one was early 1970s, involving the Stop the 70s tour.
It was an anti-apartheid movement.
Campaign. A bunch of people were arrested then, convicted, and they've had their conviction overturned nearly 50 years later. there's additional miscarriages of justice. Mark Kennedy has been the case in which Mark Kennedy is most known for was the arrest of 114 people before shutting down a power station. He was one of the 114 people arrested, and the trial was split into two parts. There was 20 people who were admitting that. Anyway, their case came to a halt when it was revealed that the evidence that Mark Kennedy had not been disclosed, which would have completely changed the outcome of the case, and their conviction was overturned. I was involved in that particular, I was one of the 114 people arrested then, so that's part of my involvement in the undercover policing inquiry. I was also arrested in 1996, something that I'd pretty much forgotten about, and is pretty irrelevant as time passes by, until I discovered that undercover officer Jim Boiling, at the time I knew him as Jim Sutton, a fellow hunt saboteur, was there with me on the day that we were arrested, and he offered to give defense a statement for the defense in my court case. I was arrested with four other people, and we were represented, a barrister representing us in court was a guy called Keir Starmer. And we won our case. We were not found guilty. We found no case to answer. And I thought nothing particularly more of it until discovering the involvement of this undercover officer. And although I was not found guilty, I believe there is a miscarriage of justice there. I sued the police and won and got some money. But like most of these cases, I had to settle out of court for a lot less money than had it gone to court and the court had decided. They would have given me more money. And we are now arguing that had we known that the involvement of the undercover police, we would not have settled and we would have got more money. There's lots and lots more cases of miscarriages of justice that are likely to emerge as the inquiry goes on.
One of the most, I'm going to jump in here because I'm looking at the pictures, but one of the most interesting cases of miscarriage of justice is the two activists who went to prison for 7 years for arson attacks on Debenhams department stores. Debenhams were selling fur coats at the time, and the Animal Liberation Front carried out incendiary device attacks against three of these stores. The idea is you planted something that would catch fire, and it sets off the sprinkler system in the building, and it destroys all the fur coats. And three of these devices were placed. One of them was placed in a building where the fire protection system was out of order, and the whole department store burnt down. Two people were arrested and went to prison for 7 years, but three department stores had these devices planted in them. And in 2011, a police officer called Bob Lambert was uncovered by activists in the UK, And they went to these two guys who'd been to prison and they said, hey, we just wanted to let you know that your old friend Bob Lambert was a police officer. And they said, no, he wasn't. And they were like, no, he really was. We know he was. Like, we have the proof. And they were like, no, he wasn't. He was the third person. He planted the third device. He can't have been a police officer. He, like, burnt the shop down. It turns out he was. And there, I believe there is an ongoing criminal investigation into him as a police officer because he denies it. He says he didn't. But the people who were involved in it were like, you know, there were four of us, and you know, we went to different towns. They weren't nearby, and we had four devices. One of them didn't work. Three of them did, and one of them was planted by this police officer. So this is something that we're seeing quite a lot, is that these political police officers will actually go a very long way to be involved, or even to organize criminal activity. It's quite an...
That was actually the next thing on my list, and okay. I was going to cover this.
Sorry.
So the next issue is agent provocateur behavior. Participation in crime, but not just like joining a already pre-existing plot to do something, but actively organizing it. So in the case of the Debenhams thing, the person who gave evidence in the inquiry talked about how Bob Lambert encouraged him. And there are other examples. We've just been hearing from the Jim Boyling's evidence and the people who gave evidence about his activity. And one of them spoke of going to Ireland to destroy a genetically modified crop. There were six people involved in that action. One of them was an undercover cop who recruited the rest of the team to go and do it. Jim Boyling was also very involved in Reclaim the Streets, and we also heard evidence from someone who Jim Boyling approached before the Carnival Against Capital, and he created a group of four people to block a road by crashing cars together. He supplied the cars, he supplied the burner phones, he found the people. They were not arrested for that, but obviously they could have been. So yes, there are lots and lots of examples. We will eventually hear more examples involving Mark Kennedy. From the disclosure, we can show that Mark Kennedy was often, and in fact the police own report into his operation, concluded that Mark was often amongst a group of maybe, you know, two, three or four people who first knew of an action, or first planned an action, or first discussed an action. We've seen disclosure in which, in a group of four people planning the squatting of the land for the first climate camp protest in 2006, out of the four people in one of these meetings, two of them were undercover officers. Something that the inquiry is not going to look at is the international activities, the overseas activities of the police, undercover police in the UK. But we have lots of information and quite a bit of disclosure relating to their overseas deployments. Unfortunately, the inquiry itself has written that out of its terms of reference, although sometimes it cheats and does talk about it. I think that's all of the main issues.
I mean, obviously there's an insane amount of information there now. So
there are currently 10,000 documents some of them hundreds of pages long, which had been uploaded onto the website of the Undercover Policing Inquiry. So that brings, that's up to like the early 90s. As you go, as you come closer to the current time, the computerization of the police force means there's the amount of information they had multiplies, and the amount of disclosure that could be published multiplies. But as they've now spent over 150 million, the inquiry are trying to reduce the amount of documents they look at and publish, because they're trying to cut corners now.
And I'm quite often asked about why I ever got involved in suing the police in the first place, and you know what justice would look like for me. And like, I don't, it's not about justice. It's certainly not about justice through the British legal system or the judicial system. It's about getting information. So, it was always about getting information and getting that information out. It has become incredibly large now. I don't think we ever imagined we would get the kind of quantities of information that we are getting. I have 50,000 pages of material that I'm supposed to read before hearings that are happening next week and the week after. It's completely insane. But it is an incredible social history project, on the one hand, because these police officers were in all of the British social movements from 1968 right up until 2010, at least. And so we have
like left-wing liberal,
left-wing liberal,
yeah, trade union.
There was a very small amount of spying on the far right. They didn't like to spy on the far right because, shock horror, the far right are really dangerous. They're violent, and they're not much fun to hang around with. Whereas, you know, like coming to the G8 camps was much more fun. There's something that we're seeing from the public inquiry that I hadn't really thought about. When you think about spies, you think about, you know, men in black with dark glasses and posh cars and like kind of this romanticized movie idea. The thing that I hadn't realized until I started reading these files was once you start an undercover operation, you take a spy like Mark Kennedy and you put him into the social center in Nottingham where I was active, and that's his job, and it's his handler's job. And it's the job of all the people in the back room who do the bureaucracy and who file the papers. And all of these people, they have a job that depends on Mark Kennedy providing intelligence that justifies him being there and being undercover. So as soon as you create undercover operations like these, you have a lot of people who have an interest in those undercover operations continuing because they need to pay their mortgage. And so there's a whole just like boring bureaucracy to it. That means, and so what you see when you read the documents is that Mark Kennedy comes back and says, oh, I went to the pub last night with this guy and he talks so much shit when he's drunk and he said maybe they would burn down the Prime Minister's house. And somebody sees that and goes, oh, great. And then they file a report saying we have intelligence that somebody might burn down the Prime Minister's house, so we need more funding. And it's like, no, you don't. Like, I read the intelligence. The intelligence says this guy got really pissed and said something stupid.
With but the literary stuff that says, you know, this guy talks shit, but that's good for us.
Yeah. So there's the intelligence, a lot of it is just really bad, and some of it is just literally invented.
And they are not only creating, like, false narratives within reporting. They were creating the very thing. They were facilitating the very thing that they were then spying on. So the classic example which, you know, we did not know about at the time, is the What's Wrong with McDonald's leaflet. I don't know if you have followed the story. It was the longest trial in English civil trial in English history. It rumbled on for ages. It cost McDonald's their reputation, and Helen and Dave defended the case with the legal advice of some guy called Keir Starmer. And it turned out, after all this, that the person who had written the leaflet was an undercover cop.
One of the people. It was a
group.
One
of the people. The group wrote the leaflet. There's other interesting examples. So this here is a poster that many people had on their walls. It's a photo from the poll tax riot. And that poster was created by an undercover cop.
Sorry.
I haven't been able to find the flyer, but Bob Lambert in 1986 produced a animal rights flyer called You Are the ALF. There were many, many examples of where the... there's a guy called Roger Pierce, who was an undercover cop who then became management of the unit. He, for a long time, was involved in an anarchist publishers called Freedom. They produced, it's still in existence, an anarchist newspaper called Freedom. He wrote, he was on the editorial team, and he wrote articles. They were anti-police articles, and they were articles that kind of that took controversial angles on issues like Northern Ireland. They were creating the political discourse, or involving themselves in the political discourse of our movements. In more recent times, towards the end of the NPOIU, there was an officer called Rob Harrison.
SDS,
yes. Rob Harrison, he used to write prolifically on an online forum called Urban 75. We got loads of examples of Mark Kennedy posting on IndyMedia. Mark Kennedy went to Barcelona and did a radio interview for the Saving Iceland campaign. He wrote for the Earth First Journal in the US. Yeah, just tons of examples where they are creating content for our movements.
When preparing for the event, we had a discussion about this agent provocateur thing, so that undercover cops, and for the German audience, we are not talking about Spitzel, we are not talking about Secret Service collaborators, we are not talking about informants, we are talking about policemen or women. So it's really, they work directly for the police and they get the money from the police. But you were not so happy with this agent provocateur idea, no? That policemen drag groups or people into militant actions to perhaps whatever, bring them to prison or whatever. So
I think it's a really complicated conversation. So we were talking about this guy who was involved in the Debenhams arson attacks, who gave evidence to the inquiry, and he said, you know, I was very young, I looked up to Bob Lambert a lot, he got me involved in the group.
This is him now, no? Or the in the last
this
decade?
This is Bob Lambert now, yeah, this is when he gave evidence to the inquiry. He said, you know, and I wouldn't necessarily have done this action if I hadn't known Bob Lambert, but I would have got there eventually. Like, I don't regret what I did. It's not, I'm not saying that, you know, he made me do this. And I think for a lot of us, that's quite a complicated thing. You know, I know that Mark Kennedy did manipulate my decisions about whether to take part in some actions or not, but I don't have any regrets about anything that I've done politically. I'm sure that's not true. I'm sure I could find things I'm embarrassed about that I've done. But, like, I don't feel like... I necessarily did things that I wouldn't have done because I was told to by a police officer. Mark Kennedy did in January 2009 at one of the no NATO meetings before in Strasbourg. He took me aside and he said, "Hey, you know, I've met some people and they're showing me how to make bombs, and do you want to know?" And I was like, "No, and if you're doing this, maybe you shouldn't be telling me." And I look back now and I'm like, fuck, like, what if I'd said yes? But so I think there are some instances where they and this stuff that happened around Mark Kennedy in 2008, 2009 is very interesting now in the context of seeing what was happening behind the scenes, that his handlers were saying to him, "That's it. You've been in undercover for 4 years. Your operation is ending." And he was going back and saying, "No, no, you can't end my operation because I know some real terrorists now and nobody else is close to them, so you have to keep me in." And he was kept in for another 2 years because of, and we've seen with, he's not the only officer that we've seen now that did this. And the Debenhams is one example. There's another example of a guy when they told him your operation is ending. He said, "No, no, because I know these people, they're planning to murder somebody and they're going to France to buy a gun." And he made up this whole story. None of it was true. And we heard all the evidence about it now. The gun was his. He had it in a safe deposit box in France. He went, they got the gun. The police seized.
But the people who went with him didn't know anything about this. He said, "I'm going to France for some business. Do you want to come? We'll buy loads of booze and bring it back to England." As far as they were concerned, it was a holiday. And literally the first they heard about it was when the raised this evidence. And they were like, what? Like,
hang on, I was there. That was
that's me they're talking about.
But behind the scenes, he was telling the police that they were buying a gun, and he said, "But you can't arrest people, because if you arrest people, then they'll find out, like, you'll expose me." So instead of arresting people, they stole the car that had the gun in it.
The police stole the car?
Yep. And they disposed of the gun.
The British police stole the car in France.
And then they filed a report saying, "We stopped a murder plot because we seized the gun and everything's fine now." Nobody was ever arrested. None of the people involved ever knew anything about it until like 3 weeks ago when they saw the secret police files.
This is actually really important. A lot of people seem to think that these political policing units were about, you know, catching criminals and that people were put in prison as a result of it. That's actually really, really rare. Like, we are not aware of any of these operations that ended with the undercover officers going to court and giving evidence against the people they provided intelligence on. When I finally got disclosure in the inquiry for the period we've just had, I didn't think there was anything going to be in there. There would be the stuff about this arrest with the undercover officer in 96, and I didn't think there would be much of interest. And when I read it, I discovered that he had named me as a person in an ALF cell and doing incendiary device attacks. And this is completely fabricated. I knew nothing about this. I don't think the attacks even happened or existed. And the first I hear about it is 30 years later. But my name was given to the counterterrorism unit at the time with the proviso from Bob Lambert, the manager at the time, "Don't make arrests, don't search." And what is the point of an undercover operation that generates intelligence, which actually names a person that's like committed 50 arson attacks and then does nothing with that information, in fact says deliberately, "Do not, because it will undermine our operation." Well, what's your operation for if not for that? And that's repeated again and again and again. The intelligence is for intelligence's sake. It's not for prosecutions. There may be prosecutions of the people who are being targeted along the way, but that is not the goal.
And now you try to find out. So they claim they had like intelligence about 50 devices being planted somewhere, and now you try to find out if there is any public record about it. And there is no newspaper article, nothing known about these 50 devices. That was in the 90s, no?
These attacks are supposed to have taken place or started to take place in the mid-1980s when Bob Lambert himself was an undercover officer in the groups which 10 years later are said to be suspected for these things. I was at school in the mid-1980s. I wasn't even a vegetarian. Mm. And these were attacks burning down butcher's shops. It's like...
I was wondering if you, I will repeat the question when Kate is back, but if you can elaborate a bit more what you found out about the structures behind it. So we already explained what a handler is, but I know, for example, the women that went to court with you, they created this. They used this wording of state-sanctioned rape. If I remember correct.
So what we can say SDS
to like that there is an apparatus behind it. It was not just one or two or 140 undercover officers. There was like an authority behind it. And what do you know about that?
I think the state-sponsored rape thing is quite important. When we first found out about Mark and about the other officers, I remember there would be a lot of comments on the newspaper articles and stuff, like, yeah, so what? He lied to you about his job. Like, men do that to get women in bed. And apart from being a really, really fucked up idea of like human relationships, it's also not the issue. And when we brought the court case, we were really clear that it wasn't a court case against the men that we had the relationships with. It was against the police as an organization, because the police are a hierarchical organization and the undercover officers are police constables. They are low-ranking police officers. They are sent in to do that job, and they have a handler who will be of a higher rank, and they have managers that go right up. And ultimately, we have 40,000 pages of information. We're drowning in the stuff that we're getting out of this inquiry, but it is there are very, very strong guardrails on what the inquiry will look at and what it won't. So we are seeing glimpses of information about how the security service were responsible for giving the tasks to the police, and that the police were effectively
like
working.
The Secret Service
in the UK, MI5, military intelligence, were requesting the police to do these jobs. We see a lot of stuff about the Home Office, Secretary of State, the Ministry of Defense, the Prime Minister, they appear, but the inquiry won't go there. They are looking at what the police did, and they're looking at what the police did in England and Wales, which means they're not looking at Northern Ireland. And a lot of significantly more fucked up stuff was probably happening in Northern Ireland at the same time. They're not looking outside of what the police were doing. It's still a lot of information that we're getting, but there's definite blind spots where we're not seeing how the structures worked.
It's on.
We do see some information about how, specifically in the early days of the SDS, how top-ranking people would visit the safe house. We see the commissioner of the police. So we know that the knowledge of the existence of the unit went high up. We know that they would produce an annual report which would go to the Home Office. The Home Office was directly funding them at the time, not the police force, the Home the Home Office was funding them. This was set up in 68. It was a Labour government when the NPOAU was created. That was under a Labour government. People always find that surprising, that it wasn't the right-wing government that set up these units. It was the left-wing government. I say that loosely.
The Home Office, which is like the Ministry for the Interior in the UK, they have destroyed all the documents relating to what the Home Office knew about this police organisation. So, and they are at the moment not wanting to give any evidence to the inquiry about their involvement. So, but the individual men who came and deceived us into relationships, the police tried to say that they didn't know, that they weren't authorised to do that, but that the evidence that we've heard in the inquiry has more or less completely, and in my court case, has more or less completely destroyed that claim by the police. It's obvious that the managers did know about it, and also that these undercover officers were given passports and driving licenses and bank accounts in false names, which made it possible for them to not be uncovered. And Mark Kennedy, he was pulled out of his deployment in early 2010, I think. No, late 2009, he was pulled out of his deployment. Anyone who knew him around that time might remember that he started to have a bit of an emotional breakdown. He said it was because his friends had been arrested. He was paranoid. And eventually he ran away. He said he was going to live in America. And he disappeared for a while. And what happened behind the scenes in that time is that he went to... he went back to the police and he was like, okay, you finished this job, what do I do now? What's my new job going to be? And he'd been undercover for 6 or 7, maybe 8 years by now. He hadn't done any additional police training in that time. He wasn't qualified to drive a police car. He wasn't qualified to use the new police radios. I think it was quite difficult to find another job for him to do in the police. And he was arrogant. He was used to being the big spy who'd worked in 22 different countries. And now he was like back in a hierarchical organization where he wasn't even qualified to drive a car. And he quit. He said, fuck this, I'm leaving. And he tried to set up in a private company. He started working for a company called Global Open, who do consulting for big corporations who may be the subject of protest. And he came back. And he came back to live with us. But of course...
He became a vegan and started going to animal rights gatherings.
He started going to animal rights gatherings all of a sudden because that's where the money is.
In 2010.
In 2010. But... he no longer had his fake driving license. He no longer had his fake passport. He no longer had his fake bank accounts because he had to give these things back when he stopped being a police officer.
He continued with identity, but not with the privileges.
But he no longer had the protection. Mm. And very quickly, he was found out because they traveled to Italy and his passport was his passport in his real name. So I think you can't underestimate the importance of the backing that these men had to enable them to deceive people like that, because once that was lost, very quickly he was found out.
Many of these officers were incredibly useful in our movements. They facilitated a lot. They were able to take on a lot because they would sit in a meeting and they would volunteer, oh, I will organize the transport, I will organize the printing. And then when they walk out of the meeting, they go on their phone and go, can you get me a load of minibuses and can you organize the printing? So they weren't even having to do the work themselves. They were just calling their handlers who would then have money and resources to do the things which they'd volunteered to do. In many ways, we were very lucky. We have, I think it was coming up to the G8 We see Mark reporting that some of the stuff that Dissent is taking on for mobilizing against the GA isn't
Dissent
going to happen.
Dissent was one of the radical networks at that time.
That some of the stuff they're trying to do isn't going to happen. There's not enough people volunteering. There's not enough money. They're struggling. It's not going to happen unless we make it happen. And they put money in so that the thing that they were going to spy on happened.
So we see reports where they say, look, if we don't lend some money to this mobilization, then it's going to fail. And like I was saying before, they don't want it to fail. They need it to succeed, because otherwise, what's the point of their job? So
this brings me to MICE. Could you explain?
So there's a lot of reporting. I mean, I said already about the files that I got, 500 people being named, and lots of personal information about people's health conditions, about people's sexuality, about people's family life, about people's relationships. And in the public inquiry, the officers that are being called to give evidence are being, they're being confronted with these reports, and the judge or the lawyers are asking them, why? Why did you report that this person was homosexual? Why did you report that this person was breaking up with their wife? Why did you report the childcare arrangements for this person and their children? And the cops who are giving evidence, they're all liars. They're all trained liars. But you start to see glimpses of behind what's going on. And one of the things that has been said, I wish we had the Trevor Morris video where he says it, but one of the things that they say is, well, you know, we collected this information to have power over people. And they talk, they've talked about this acronym, which is MICE, which refers to the leverage that they would use to get people to become police informants. So we're looking, like the information that we're getting from the inquiry is about police spies. So these are police officers who are employed to infiltrate the movements, and they're being paid a salary as a police officer to pretend to be somebody else and infiltrate our movements.
A lot of overtime.
And yeah, a lot of overtime. Like, but of course, that's not the only way that the police gather information and intelligence about our movements. And another very important way that they gather intelligence is through real people who are genuinely part of the movement. They're not pretending to be someone else, but they are paid by the police to give information about the movement.
But what is MICE standing for then?
I'm getting to that. And those people have to be recruited by the police. They have to find people. They have to find the right people. They have to find the right levers to pressure those people to give them information. And this personal information that the undercover police gather about people feeds into that process. And MICE stands for money, ideology, compromat, and ego. And these are the four things that they were looking for.
Perhaps we have to explain compromat.
So money is obvious. They look for people who have money problems, and they go to them and they say, oh, you have money problems. We will pay you to give us information. Ideology is a little bit more complicated, but we heard evidence very recently from a guy who I know from Reclaim the Streets, who was taken by the police one day. He was on his way to work. They arrested him, and they took him on a long drive, and they talked to him, and they said, hey, you know, we know you're a good guy, you're an environmentalist, and you're part of Reclaim the Streets, and we see that these anarchists and people who are more interested in violence are becoming involved. You don't want it to be violent. We don't want it to be violent. Let's work together. And he said, no, fuck off. And he came back and he told us what had happened. But This is an example of how they tried to use somebody's beliefs and their ideology to get them to give information to the police. Kompromat is probably the most powerful.
Relating to your, your drug habit, your gambling problem, or your arrests that you've had, or some kind of legal problem that they can fix,
or your sexuality, or your immigration status that you have trouble with, and they come and they say, "Okay, you do what we ask, we solve your problem, or we don't tell people about your problem. You don't do what we ask, and we will use this information against you." And I think this is one of the most powerful ways that they do it. And then ego, I think, is really important for us to understand as a movement, because this is where people who have been hurt, people who have been excluded, people who feel like they're not being given the recognition that they deserve, people who are not feeling supported by the movement, become vulnerable to the police coming and saying, they don't appreciate you, but we do. And I think particularly in our anarchist movements, where a lot, like the police, I think we also maybe call them lifestyle movements, but where it's not just like something that you do at the weekend, you go to the political meeting, but it's a way that people live, and your whole social circle and your relationships and your life are all tied up with the political activism that you're doing, then these kind of personal interactions become really difficult. And I think it shows how important it is to support each other and make sure that people are not vulnerable to that kind of pressure. And
we can talk about your idea later in the Q&A.
Yeah, sure. I think we should open it up to questions.
You were talking about Mark coming back as a corporate spy and trying to continue where he left off. He failed. I want to just clarify what this is up here. So there was a while when Mark Kennedy was kind of lost to us. But then we discovered he was working in security at a holiday park. We also discovered at some point since then that and played in a band called Barnstormer, which don't seem to have him as a member anymore when it was outed on German indie media for some reason. And the last we heard of him was that he is now a specialist in hot tub procurement for hotels.
Working as a furniture salesman, effectively. Anyway, this is the last sighting. Somebody actually applied for a job at this company, and they went to the website to check before they went for their interview to read up a little bit about the company, and they went to the page that says Meet the Team, and they found this. The company have been contacted. Apparently he does not work for them anymore, so we don't know what he's doing now.
Thank you very much for this. Lots of information. Some applause.
Can I say something brief? That Mark Kennedy's spying in Germany was considered illegal and unconstitutional. I want to mention that. Came out in, a judge decided here in 2022 his spying here was unconstitutional.
Thanks. Just a question. Has the British police changed what it's doing after the revelations, or could it be that they're still carrying on the same thing with new people?
The British police have they only really say anything about this issue anymore when they're issuing yet another grovelling apology to different groups of people about what they did. And they say that the British police, or certainly the Metropolitan Police, are no longer deploying police officers in this way. So they've certainly changed the way they talk about it. I think you have to really unpack a lot of what they say very carefully. And the statement, the British police are no longer deploying police officers in this way, does not mean that they are not hiring private companies to do it. It does not mean that they are not spying on political movements in different ways. I think that after the outing of Mark Kennedy, but not only after the outing of Mark Kennedy, also with the different way that people now interact with data and the internet, it becomes quite difficult for them to take police officers and deploy them in this way. We've had a number of cases in the Spanish state where undercover officers have been discovered because people start to have suspicions and they take the photographs and they use facial recognition technology with pictures of police graduations and find the correlation between the faces and identify. And they found, I think, 9 undercover officers in the Spanish state in the last few years, mostly using that technology. So I think it's harder for them. It's very hard now for somebody to have no footprint on the internet, for young people coming up through the police training to be able to go undercover and have no identifiable past. So
it's worth saying that those officers who were deployed and discovered in the Spanish state were deployed after Kate's IPT ruling ruled that the operations were unlawful and undemocratic and had breached a whole litany of human rights, which would obviously also have applied in Spain.
I mean, the Spanish state basically saw the violations of the European Convention on Human Rights that were declared in 2018 and went, oh, that's a good idea, and took a whole class of police officers and like it was like the class of 2018 from the Mallorca police training, I think, and they just put them all undercover into the social movements across Spain. I mean, it's just fucking, yeah. Spanish state is a class of its own.
About if there is any change in the within the police with all the revelations, I read that this is one of the goals of the inquiry. Whenever it will end, that it gives like proposals, which I don't know, could be in 2030, 2035 or something, and then it will take years. I mean, if they are in any way positive or interesting or important.
Yes, so when the inquiry was launched, one of the things that it was supposed to do was to make recommendations on how none of this would happen again. Pretty soon after the inquiry was launched, there was a thing called the CHIS Act, Covert Human Intelligence Sources, which before the inquiry even got going, basically legalized everything that has already happened. And we did a Freedom of Information request, which provided us with correspondence between the then Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, and the chairman of the inquiry, in which she said, do less. I want you to look at less evidence, and I want you to not look at the impact of undercover policing, which was one of the things that the inquiry is supposed to be doing, and not make recommendations. And he said, effectively, I'm already taking a sampling approach to the evidence, which is what she asked. But if I put that in writing and say that that's what I'm doing, then the core participants will, you know, drag me through the courts.
I think the point is that the recommendations made by a retired British establishment judge about the future of undercover policing are probably not what is going to change what they do. What changes what they do is getting caught and being exposed. We're not holding our breaths for the findings of the inquiry. What we're interested in is the evidence that is coming out.
And to understand how it works, how we spot it, and how we continue to organize and be effective, even acknowledging the kind of repression that we can expect.
Thank you very much for the very detailed talk about especially the UK reality. I would be a little bit interested to understand what, for all these thousands and thousands of files, if you manage to understand a little bit more about the international, like the interest around international contacts, because as we know, Mark was extensively in Berlin and has been all over Europe. If you manage to find anything like why it was so important for him, like to be around, what kind of evidence, what kind of, I mean, besides obviously what is our individual speculations, I'm talking about the artifacts, if you found out anything that can be relevant, interesting for us.
Yeah, there's, so I think, very, very easy to speculate and to you know, imagine stuff, and I try to avoid that with the stuff that we do because it's like a rabbit hole that has madness at the bottom of it. But we have got some evidence. We got the authorizations for Mark Kennedy to come to Germany. We have the information about the people that he was targeting when he came here. But I think, from my knowledge of the targeting, it's not very useful information. So when I moved to Germany in May 2005, the British police wrote an authorization for Mark Kennedy. This was the first time they'd ever named me in one of the authorizations. And it says that I am a specific named target of the operation because I am a key organizer at the Cornerstone Housing Co-op in Leeds. And at that time, I was living abroad. I was living at in Riegerstrasse. Mark Kennedy, his handler, his managers all knew where I was living, and they lied on their authorization document to make me the target of their operation so that they could then follow me to Berlin. And I think, and maybe Matthias knows a little bit more about this, but I think that the UK police force actually set themselves up to sell intelligence to other countries. They made themselves specialist in this kind of spying. And they would work for foreign police forces. So Mark went to, I mean, he says in his newspaper interviews that he worked for 22 different countries. We haven't managed to count all of them. And I think some of that working for different countries actually meant that he went to international cross-border policing meetings and talked to police forces from all of those countries. But I think, you know, we know he was in Poland, we know he was in Italy, we know he was in the United States. We know that he had a work visa for the United States in his passport that was valid until 2013. We know he worked for the FBI, we know he worked for a number of police forces in Germany because we've had the parliamentary answers about those processes. We know that he was doing something in Oslo that wasn't, like, so Mark's, he was in Iceland spying
with
on
this
activists.
Big Dam protest, yeah. Very important protest. That was, to my knowledge, it was like when the radical climate movement started, no? That was like 2006?
No, he went to Iceland in 2005, I guess. It was straight
it
after
competed
the G8.
With the G8 for people's attention. Yeah.
He left from the G8 to go. But yeah, the Oslo thing was different because Mark Stone used to tell me that he went to Oslo, but I don't know of any contact that he had with the activist movements there. And I've seen stuff in the police files that talks about Mark, you know, telling people he would spread stuff in Norway or talking about Oslo. And the way that they talk about it makes me think that it was actually some kind of police contact that he had. There was some kind of international thing that they did that took place in Norway.
Yeah, some kind of Interpol conference or something going on. Well, who knows? But I think it's important to say he was definitely not the first officer to do a lot of to have overseas deployments, and the kind of fantasizing and creating their own narrative in order to justify deployments often involves the overseas stuff, and the overseas stuff is a bit of a jolly. I don't know if that's a term that translates, but it's like an opportunity for the handlers to have a bit of a all expenses paid holiday somewhere. So the intelligence value may have been a little bit made up.
And it's also a lot easier when you're crossing borders to for them to make stuff up, because, you know, it's very difficult to check. It's quite complicated, the relationship that the British police had with spying in other countries. But there's a lot of the officers did it. They did it on holiday. You know, Mark came to visit me in Barcelona and we like hung out. We went to the beach. We ate ice cream. Like we really didn't do any politics at all. So they definitely did that sort of thing. And there were at least three different British undercover officers in Genoa, in Italy, in 2001. And not next week, but the week after, we will be hearing evidence from one of those officers who was actually inside the Diaz school when it was attacked by the Italian
police.
What
was his name?
Carlo Soracchi. His cover name was Carlo Neri. He's get his picture up. He was spying on the Socialist Party, and he went to Genoa with the British Socialist Party, and he presumably was quite badly beaten up by the Italian police in 2001. This guy was also in Genoa. We don't have the picture of him. There's a great picture of him in a gas mask standing in front of a burning barricade in Genoa.
The SDS also did team building holidays together. They went to Las Vegas, they went to Amsterdam, not sure where else they went. Mark Kennedy met his handler in Amsterdam in the red light district.
No, in Hamburg.
In Hamburg, in the red light district for a meeting. And after this meeting, he comes out and he's discovers his passport has been stolen by prostitutes.
It's also explained in the book, if I'm not mistaken. No? Sorry.
One comment and one question. There is a very interesting case in Italy with the undercover police infiltrating search and rescue operation in the central Mediterranean. And there hasn't been such amount of accountability on that operation. So thank you for, you know, being consistent and for the courage you put into this. But what is interesting about the undercover operation in Italy is that it put a lot of criminalization on activists and search and rescue operation. So I want to know if that also was the case in the UK, like how it turned out in terms of the activist movement and what was the impact in terms of criminalizing
I think it's very hard to say what the impact of the undercover policing was on the activist movement, because you have this conflicting thing, like I said before, that for the undercover police, it's really important for them that the activist movements are successful, because otherwise they have no reason to keep their jobs.
Jim Boyling, in his evidence last week, and obviously he's a liar, so don't take this at face value, but he specifically said that it was a cliche within the SDS, that when the SDS targeted a group, that group would flourish.
On the other hand, I think in the UK, in the same way as everywhere in Europe, they are criminalizing social movements. They've been doing it systematically for a very long time. I mean, certainly the mid-1990s, when I first got involved, they were passing new laws to criminalize different kinds of protest, and we've now got to the point in 2025 where they're declaring direct action movements to be terrorist organizations in the UK. So, like, the criminalization is definitely happening, but I think I don't know what the specific role of the undercover police is in that dynamic.
What we can say a bit is that the effect of the discovery of the undercover operations was devastating to our movements. Basically, they collapsed and people couldn't trust each other anymore. There's this thing called the chilling effect, and people, it was a kind of an end of an era for a lot of things, and then a younger generation who were even not aware of that, and there was a period of time where there just wasn't a crossover. Young people were doing like student protests against fees for universities and stuff started to become big at the time that
and
the other movements completely collapsed. And just
so there was just no generational crossover. There's like in 2010 you have this gap really with very few of the older generation carrying on into the newer younger movements that were taking place. I think they did more damage after they were found out than they did when they were inside.
They were very helpful when they were there. And of course, while they were there, a lot of people didn't get arrested for things because they they couldn't get arrested without exposing the undercover unit. So that's also worth saying.
Hello. Yeah, my question was about how you deal with the chilling effect, because there is an incredible amount of paranoia in the movement that anybody you meet might be a cop, and I think this like general turning inwards is probably more harmful than the occasional cop actually popping up, and like these discussions kind of are like, oh, you don't want to be careful, you don't care about security, and it kind of seems self-defeating.
It's a really difficult question to answer. I mean, one of the things that I always try to say when I do these talks is everything that happened to us, I don't regret anything that I did. I would have done it again. And, you know, they were spying on us because we were doing something right. And I really don't want doing these talks to discourage anybody from standing up for what they believe in and from taking action. I think it's really important to understand how they operated and what they do and the lengths that they will go to. At the same time, like I said, you know, when Mark was first uncovered, we felt like, oh my God, if Mark was a cop, anyone could be a cop. But really, that wasn't true. You know, it's not that simple to lead a double life. It's not that simple to spy on people. I don't think it's even that simple to inform on the movements, you know, for real people to sell information to the police. These aren't, you know, these are, you know, if it's any consolation, I don't think that very, very, very few of the marriages of these officers survived their undercover deployments, and very few of them came out of it with their mental health intact. I mean, we've been seeing a lot of them giving evidence, and you know, they are very clearly very, very damaged human beings as a result of this. I mean, some of them are still very clearly very, very nasty human beings, but you know, all of them clearly suffered serious mental health damage as a result of the work that they were doing. I think it's very, a lot of people ask me, like, you know, well, what do you do if you're in a movement now? What do you do? How do you decide whether to be open or whether to close in on yourself? And I think it's a really difficult question to answer in general terms, because I think it really depends, you know, what you're doing, who might want to stop you doing what you're doing, what the consequences might be. You know, I mean, most of the work that I was involved in was quite public mobilizing for quite like open activities, and mostly the biggest consequence of the police finding out what we were doing was that the action would go wrong. But at the end of the day, like most of the actions I was involved in, they were going to find out I did it eventually, because I'd be locked to the thing or up a fucking tripod, or, you know, so you keep it secret until the day, and then they know you're there because you're standing there with a banner. But obviously there are other kinds of political action where that's not how it works, and actually the plan is to do it quietly and get away, and obviously then the consequences of having somebody in the group who knows who you were and what you did is much more serious. So it's
but it's interesting how many of those kind of small cell type things, which the evidence shows that the police were interested in getting into, but like in the case of Bob Lambert, they actually create those cells. They're not getting into existing cells. People form small cells and do stuff amongst a friendship group when undercover officers appear to have managed to get into those cells. It's because they found people to join them.
So we talked now for 2 hours, so I think we slowly come to an end. So if there is a pressing question, we can definitely have that. You, please.
First, I want to thank you, and I'm very surprised that you didn't cry. So I would have cried during the presentation. I wanted also to ask about the consequences for the movement. You already talked about that. And I also wanted to know if, of reading the files, you can know more or less what kind of psychological profile do they select in order to be a cover police. I'm trying to understand how they're trained, and how they're like organized in order to be. Yes, they're not like the chiefs of the police, but I think they will be like a kind of a psychological profile, or specific psychological profile. And if you talk,
I mean, this is part of the problem for the state. I mean, it becomes a problem for us, but really, it's a problem for the state of having these kind of secret organizations. Because what we see is that, first of all, so they did in the 1990s, they started to introduce, first, they used to just pick people like, hey, you look fun, why don't you come and join our police unit? And then they, in the 1990s, they started to introduce psychometric testing. Mark Kennedy failed his psychometric testing. Quite a lot of them failed their psychometric testing. Mark Kennedy was allowed to take a resit. Like, I don't think you're supposed to be, if like a psychometric test is about your basic psychology and personality, you're not supposed to be able to revise a bit more and resit it and pass it the second time. And what we see really powerfully in these organizations is that because they need good intelligence to justify the existence of the unit, if somebody goes, somebody comes to, I don't know, the Maoist group in London to infiltrate, and they go to the meeting and they come out and they say, they're just a political study group. They read some of Chairman Mao's writings, they talk about it, they have a beer, they go home. There's really no need for us to be spying on these people. That's accurate intelligence, but that operation ends at that point. The guy that goes and says, well, they look like they're just reading some Mao stuff, but they have some seriously subversive revolutionary ideas, and I think we need to keep an eye on them, and I'm going to go back to the next meeting. That guy keeps the meeting keeps the operation going for weeks and months, and they end up getting commendations at the end. And so the more creative and the more interesting they were with their intelligence, the more brutal they were in the way that they deceived people and manipulated people, the more successful their deployments were. And those are the people that get promoted. And over 50 years, you have this secret organization with no real oversight, and nobody's really checking what they're doing. And we're now getting to the bit at the end where you see that by the end, the people who are running the unit are the people who went undercover. They deceived four different women into relationships. They fathered a child while they were undercover. And then they came out of their undercover deployment and they're put in charge of the unit and they train the next guys coming in. And you have this kind of spiraling mission creep and abuse that's going on within the unit. And by the time it's closed down, the police officers who come in to close the unit down and pack it up are writing reports where they are absolutely horrified by what they're seeing. But because it's been secret and uncontrolled for so long, it's like gone completely off the rails, you know? So the training is a problem, definitely.
Perhaps we end it with something like what can we do? And some things you said already. But we had this conversation about what can we also do with informants, like people who are working for the Secret Service or for the police, like the case that we in Germany, many of you, I assume, came across this person who was this close in Bremen, which was not an undercover cop, which was like an informant, as far as we know. So they got some money for giving information. So what we can do to prevent this, or even take the people on our side, or drag them out of this system. We have this conversation in the afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, so we were talking about this because we were talking about the mice, the money, ideology, kompromat, and ego situation, but also about the situations we know where people have been approached by the police and they try to make them become informants. And many times they pick people who are vulnerable. They pick people who are in trouble. They pick people who have maybe been arrested for drugs, or they've been arrested for something else, something small, but they have children who are young, and they say, hey, you want to see your children grow up? Then we can sort this problem for you if you start to give us information. And I've know some friends of mine who have immigration problems, and they go to the police to have their immigration interview, and the police say, okay, you don't have the right to stay here, but we know that you're friends with this anarchist group, so let's make a deal. You give us information about the anarchist group and we sort out your permission to stay. And this is something that I think benefits the police a lot, and it's puts... Once a person has said, yes, I will sell you information, they're fucked. Because if people find out that they're selling information to the police, they lose their social circle, they lose their support networks, they lose everything in the movement. So the only person they can talk to after that is their police handler. The only person who really knows the truth about what's happening is their police handler. And I remember having a conversation years ago with someone who said, what we need is an amnesty service for people who are police informants, where you say, you can come to us, and you know, you probably can't go back to the movements that you were spying on, but there is somewhere that we will support you and we will provide, you know, what you need to get out of that situation. You know, we will provide the legal support if you need help with your immigration. We will provide the backing that's necessary for you to extract yourself from that situation and be able to talk to people about what happened. Because the reactions that I've seen in the movement when people suspect people of being police informants are quite harsh and quite hostile, But the reality that I know about people who've been approached to become police informants and the realities that we know about are pretty much always the people who said no. I remember hearing one story from the Basque Country 30, 40 years later where the woman came and spoke about the fact that she had become a police informant and the people that she informed on died. But she was able, years later, to get together with the people from that movement who weren't killed and talk to them about what had happened and the fact that she had been a police informant. And they came to do a talk together in Barcelona. And it was really fucking powerful. And it really made me think that, you know, we don't know the stories of the people who do become police informants because they would never dare come forward and tell us. And so as a movement, I think we need that kind of amnesty.
Mm. If you can create the environment in which people can eventually say, fuck you to the police, I'm done. And it very much will disempower that as a tactic for the police. Once somebody has provided one little piece of information, they're stuck in a loop where they'll just have to continue. And from our side of it, we contribute to their being trapped. And if we could do anything to make them less trapped in the hands of the police, then we would be fucking the police.
Obviously, it's a complex conversation. It's just an idea, but...